Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
This is a top to, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, 11,
and most of
11,
the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Boxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Boxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4 head-on. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody, welcome aboard Foxed Up here for a Wednesday night, Thursday morning, or Thursday afternoon, all depending on where you reside on this beautiful blue marble, such that it still is, at least in many places. I'm assuming many of you that are listening now were listening to the Horn section previously, and we were talking about, and on the out, I kind of made mention that I believe the voting machine and rigging situation, I think, is really beginning to see the light of day, and I think we're actually going to see some serious dealings with it between now and November. And just as we were going out from the Horn section, Gene in the chat room sends me a Brad blog link. And here you go. Scientific American blasts e-voting. Okay. Now, there's lots of legal stuff going on, but see, it's just constantly hammering people with the fact that just the concept of electronic voting is not to be trusted. It's just too easy to mess with. But they say he, I love Brad, he's great. He goes, those conspiracy theorists over at Scientific American just refuse to move on and get over it. Here's the latest headline from those wackos. Understand, you know, Brad, this is tongue firmly in cheek. Planning to e-vote? Read this first. Subtitled, with less than 3 months before the presidential election, the hotly contested state Ohio, along with others, continue to have problems with e-voting technology. The tinfoil hatters over there, so-called scientists, have the temetry to report stuff like this. And this is from the article. None of the systems out there are even remotely adequate given the importance of the data they handle, says Patrick McDaniel, a Penn State professor of information security who led the Everest testing on behalf of the state of Ohio. A lot of the attacks that McDaniel and his team tested could be carried out at a polling place or county elections office in a matter of seconds. An example, when researchers placed a piece of white tape over part of an e-voting system scanner, they were able to effectively block it from reading the entire ballot. The team also found that the keys to unlock Hart's ballot box could also be used to open the ballot boxes on the Premier Diebold systems. I'm telling you. I really think it's taken 8 long years. But we've got the rumblings. And, of course, the media is not covering it. But it actually doesn't mean that it's not happening. You pay attention to sources that are actually watching this. And stuff is happening. You got to go to velvetrevolution.us. You got to see the videos. You got to go there. There's about an hour's worth of videos where the people who are fronting the case, you know, making the case in this, I think it's the state of Ohio versus Diebold case, they lay out everything that they found. They lay out all the connected dots. They lay out the Republican operative IT guy that Rove is now threatening. So I continue to get more and more hopeful, even though at the moment just watching the news lately is just so unbelievably depressing. First of all, the Olympic sham just drives me crazy because it's just a PR campaign for China that should never have been given these games. If someone can explain to me why, not like I really care, but this did throw me, why is softball being pulled from the Olympics? I don't understand, but hey, I'm not going to ask anymore. But anyway, check out the Brad blog. I'm looking forward to, after the show, checking out that entire piece from Scientific American. But if you were tuning in last night when David rang in, he reported something very, very special and very, very odd. Burning Spear, reggae genius, who has been fighting for 37 years to get the rights to his own catalog of music, has actually gotten it all. And this rarely happens. This rarely happens that an artist who has lost their catalog due to dubious contracts or, you know, dubious record labels. Oh, shock horror. They're dubious record labels? Yeah, they've all become Sony now. Remember CBS? Sony was CBS, just to remind everyone. But Burning Spear's gotten 37 years of the music that he has created that he has actually not made his money on. He now owns it. So we have to play some Burning Spear today. Now, unfortunately, see, when it comes to reggae, I have to go to the expert, which is my lovely Gail. And it was a bit of a hectic night last night, so we didn't get time for Gail to program the list for me. So I grabbed a few off of one record. We will do another day of Burning Spear, because I think that this is so huge. You know, I know it's just a music story, and I know it's just about, you know, one reggae guy. But these victories come so rare in this business. And so many musicians actually get the most powerful piece of anything that they own, which is the publishing rights. And he's gotten it all back, which means all of that content, he'll actually be, he says in his statement, I finally get to reap what I sow. And I was very nervous because I went to go to fudgefm.com, which is David Fermain's website. And during the horn section, it was under maintenance. So I was really, really kind of scared that I wasn't going to be able to get this slightly cleaned up version of the text. And so you can read this over at fudgefm.com, and you just roll down a bit and you'll see a big, beautiful picture of Burning Spear. He basically says, finally, I will reap what I sow. First, I must say greetings to all the people of the world. I attempt to write this journal about three times, and I couldn't find the words to express myself to you the way I wanted to, so I retreated until Joss sent me the words. After more than 37 years in the music business, I will finally reap what I sow. It was a lesson in strength and determination to stay the course, no matter what. I couldn't envision what was coming my way in form of the fear and intimidation and extortion of money and destruction of property by a few in the music business. These unconscious ones left no stone unturned to destroy my business because they could no longer reap all the fruit of Burning Spear labor. One thing they forget was to have an exit plan. They had the power of a big record label advising as what to do, so they never thought they would have the need for an exit plan. To them, we would simply go away. Little did they know we would stand strong. This is not a fight about money. For us, it's about integrity and honesty. Equal rights for all. No one should ever had to endure what we went through without cause. And the entire world needs to know about it. If we remain silent and don't speak up, either in a blog or journal or other media, the system of intimidation will continue against reggae artists. So many of my peers who are no longer with us and never got the chance to reap what they sow are the foundation of reggae music, and we desire to be treated with respect. We have a right to say no. Some of this is a little hard to read and misspelled. And that none should be taken and honored just like any other no. Oh, well, you get the point. And I think we'll actually get into some of the tracks, but you're getting the idea. 37 years, and the label owns everything this man created. And probably has survived purely on the touring when he wasn't getting screwed by the promoter. So I reckon, because he just said it in his post about standing strong, we got four tracks here. We're going to get through all four. It is a moral imperative. So just to begin things, I Stand Strong, Burning Spear, love it. Chill, roll it, Bob.
I stand strong in a Babylon. I stand strong in a Babylon. I stand strong in a Babylon. I stand strong. I didn't do no wrong. 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 This majesty Babylon, I stand strong in a Babylon.
For once in the music industry, standing strong actually paid off. Congratulations to Burning Spear for being able to reclaim what's rightfully, you know, any artist, all they ever have is the product that they create. And for a distributor to take ownership, it's just absolute shit. Bob was saying in the chat while we were listening to that track, saying, why does Babylon get such a bad rap? Everything I read says it was a pretty amazing place. And yes, Bob, the same exact thing happened to Creedence Clearwater Revival. It's the example that I always use when the idea of someone's catalog being taken or signed off or, you know, signed over via dodgy contract. That is the classic example. Every single one of those classic Creedence Clearwater Revival songs, John Fogerty never saw a penny for. Some of the biggest selling songs in music history. And the deal was so disgusting that anything that he put pen to paper, whether completed, recorded, or not, if he put pen to paper, they owned it. So he sat patiently, didn't play or write a thing, didn't even do guest performances. And people thought he was becoming a recluse. No. He was protecting his ass because he learned the hard way. So, then, when the contract finally expires, all those years later, up come the what? Middle 80s, when Centerfield came out, and that really was an amazing record. I still think that's a really great record. And that was, you know, over a decade, probably, of pent-up creativity that had been stifled. Now, there are a lot of people that report that John Fogerty is one of the biggest pricks in music. Now, I don't know that for sure. However, if I got screwed like that, I might start coming back as a prick too. And Bob's saying John Fogerty's return. Did I have the wrong album? Was there one before Centerfield? Or is that... I'm just trying to decode something Bob's trying to convey to me. No, I had it right. Okay. I didn't brain fart. Woohoo! But, you know, it is the classic example of... And this is one of the reasons why I love this era of new media that we're in. Where I'd rather give it away to the listeners for free than to have the label own it and control it. Because I don't know about anybody else. When I create music, I create music for it to be heard and for it to affect people. And I am one of those that believes that if you create something good, the money will come. But hey, some people have to wait 37 years for that to come around. And I wonder if he's going to be able to get any, like, you know, back royalties or anything. Could be interesting. I have to talk to David at some point and see about getting some more detail about exactly how all this went down. But just to move on, we're going to go and play another one here. Which one am I going to do? I think we'll go with this is all off the same album. Like I said, I was a little, you know, I was hampered by the fact that I didn't have, that the reggae expert and I didn't quite get to put this list together. I am not an expert on these things. However, I do love the stuff. So I just went to this one record that we had, and I picked four tracks. And I think it's because of this particular one, which I've always really dug. And it's a track called In a Time Like Now. And it's just a great song. This is great music. So without further ado, Burning Spear, In a Time Like Now. Roll it, Bob.
Time like now, things are strange.
got his own, you know, version of reggae, doesn't he? You know, there's a definite difference between, say, a Burning Spear and a Bob Marley in there. It's completely different vibe. Pardon me just a moment, having a bit of, hey, there we go, just having a bit of weirdy over on my end, but it's all fixed now. Before we play some more music, I found this fascinating. Thank you, Gene. Gene's posted this at the Head On Radio Network blog. And, you know, I've spoken at great length about bee colony collapse. Bee colony collapse, right? Been talking about this. And what's been kind of coming down is that it's probably around a pesticide. Well, here you go. Here is your government not working for the people. In fact, working diametrically opposed to the safety and well-being of the population of not just the United States, but the entire planet. Lawsuit seeks EPA pesticide data. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which has now become such an Orwellian term, it's a joke, is refusing to disclose records about a new class of pesticides that could be playing a role in the disappearance of millions of honeybees in the United States. In a lawsuit filed Monday. The Natural Resources Defense Council wants to see the studies that the EPA required when it approved a pesticide made by Bayer's Crop Science 5 years ago. The environmental group filed the suit as part of an effort to find out how diligently the EPA is protecting honeybees from dangerous pesticides, and said Aaron Colangelo, a lawyer for the group in Washington. In the last 2 years, beekeepers have reported unexplained losses of hives, 30% and upward, leading to a phenomenon called colony collapse disorder. Scientists believe that the decline in bees is linked to an onslaught of pesticides, mites, parasites, and viruses, as well as a loss of habitat and food. $15 billion in crops. Okay. Hopefully that's a little better for you, Bob. So bees pollinate about one-third of the human diet. $15 billion worth of U.S. crops, including almonds in California, blueberries in Maine, cucumbers in North Carolina, and 85 other commercial crops, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Not finding a cause of the collapse would prove costly, scientists warn. Representatives of the EPA said they hadn't seen the suit and couldn't comment. Aha, here we go, here we go, here we go. We don't like what we're being asked, so we're just going to deny its very existence. Clothianidin is the pesticide at the center of the controversy. It is used to coat corn, sugar beet, and sorghum seeds, and is part of a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. The pesticide was blamed for bee deaths in France and Germany, which also is dealing with a colony collapse. Those two countries have suspended its use until further study. An EPA fact sheet from 2003 says that the pesticide has the potential for toxic chronic exposure to honeybees as well as other pollinators through residues in nectar and pollen. The public has no idea whether those studies have been submitted to the EPA or not. If so, what they show? Maybe they never came in. Maybe they came in and they show a real problem for bees. Maybe they're poorly conducted and it doesn't satisfy the EPA's requirements. So here we go again. And I mean, it's the little things that could affect us the most. I mean, this is a serious, serious problem. You know, it's like we need to put a dollar value on the unpaid work that Mother Nature does for us. It's just mad. But no, the EPA says, we don't know about the suit. We can't respond. Well, actually, you just found out about the suit come up with the studies. Come up with the data. You bastards. You lying sacks of shit. You know, this is the same protection agency that deemed Ground Zero in New York City as being safe for people to go get into when the data didn't support it. Starting to sound a lot like the Monsanto studies on genetic modification. All the studies are paid for by the people who want to be able to sell this shit. So for people like that, for like Monsanto, the bee colony collapsed, they're like going, woo, buddy! We're gonna make us some money! Because they can't save our seeds. They don't replicate. Oh, baby! Our friends over at Bayer are doing a great job for us here at Monsanto. We're going to own everything you eat. Son of a bitch. Really? I mean, really? I mean, this just shows you what has happened to, you know, this just criminality and dishonesty that this administration has injected into our government has just seeped into every crevice. And I mean, and this stuff goes way back, too. I mean, the stuff when it comes to genetic modification, Bush won, baby. Bush won. He's the one that went and did all those, you know, appearances at the Monsanto plants going, oh, isn't this great? And you'll pay for your own studies and then you can tell us all that it's all safe and we're gonna believe it. Because it's all about business. Fuck human life. And that is exactly how these people are. Getting the impression I needed to be on air more the last couple of weeks. Boy, have I been aggro the last couple of days. But this stuff is really, 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 really shitting me. Song first, story first. Nah, song first. I think I need to breathe yet again. And here we go. Here's a good one. Just for this. Because people don't understand what's going on around them. More from Burning Spear. The world should know. And I think that's a big problem because the world doesn't really know what the hell is happening to their own planet. In their own backyard. Because they put blinders on. So Bob, cue up The World Should Know and roll it.
There is enough for one and all. So
Yeah, there's a whole lot that the world should know. this might not make much sense to you, being that it's an Australian thing, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Last night, our just great national broadcaster, the ABC, had a really special little presentation on last night. A young stage writer and musician wrote a musical about a former prime minister, about Keating. Now, this guy was a Labor guy who was in power in the early 90s. I think it was 90 to 96, if I'm not mistaken. And this guy was a character. And we're talking an ego the size of a truck. And so last night, they actually broadcast a live performance of the musical on not just the network, but at major cinemas all over the country. Now, I only got to catch about half of it last night because phone calls and other things. And it was an amazingly clever piece of work. And the cast is a six-member band and three performers. It's one guy who plays Keating through the entire thing. Then the other two guys play multiple characters through 20-some years of Australian politics. And the funniest one had to be John Howard, our booted, recently booted ex-prime minister. It was one of the, first of all, the music's great. It's this great band. They can play anything. They go everything from reggae to rap to country to jazz. You know, it just goes all over the place. And I just thought it was a really, you know, this thing's been selling out shows for, I think, almost 2 years now. And, you know, musicals are things that lots of people hear about and most of the population don't actually get to see. And instead of the producers and the owners thinking, wow, we let the nation see this, we might not sell any more tickets. But no, they didn't think that. They said, no, this is a great idea. First of all, massive exposure. Second of all, you know, the show is entertainment. It doesn't get heavy into the actual politics. But it's about the characters involved. I'd love to see someone do something like this on, say, actually, Clinton would be an interesting one. But, you know, and while I was watching it, you know, this is all history that happened long before I got here. So, you know, some of the nuance I didn't have. But it was incredibly well written, incredibly entertaining, and I thought it was just the coolest thing that the ABC decided to, you know, and it's a commercial-free thing, so, you know, and so they showed this, you know, people actually creating, and, you know, and the fact that they did it actually completely live, not live taped and then rebroadcast, no. They did it in the way that is the most risky, but at the same time, the most rewarding. And Keating himself was in the audience. Now, he's enough of an egomaniac. And I actually like the guy. People seem to, a lot of people on both sides of politics think he's a prick. But see, I've only seen him since, you know, he hasn't been in power. And every time I see him, he speaks about both parties really openly. And I think he's got a great grasp on politics in general. But I mean, this guy had an ego the size of a truck, and he's a compelling guy. He's not afraid to get angry, you know, he's very human. But I'm really hoping that they'll make it available on their iView player at some point. And if they do, I'm going to post it at the Horn, because I really, really think, even though you wouldn't know anything about the politics, the music and the characters, and once you get to Act Two, you'll see Johnny Howard, which many of you might recognize, and it's hysterical. They dress, and they show him very much like Bush, being dressed up in the costumes for every little, you know, event. You know, when he goes and visits the troops, you know, they put him in flak jackets and camouflage and hand him a big gun. And, you know, in the lyrics, they play on the idea that he'll never say sorry to the Aboriginals. And they take the living piss out of him. And it's just so Australian. It was just so beautiful. So, if this thing pops up, I will definitely make it available. And the music's great. The music's great. The band is kick-ass. I mean, I like any band where I see the bass player up there. And, you know, there's the five-string electric bass and the double bass. And switching between them like it's nobody's business. Two guitar players, two keyboard players. Awesome. Anyway, time to move on. Bob and I were talking in the Horn section about, you know, we're the biggest importer, we're the biggest exporter. Well, some of that might be right. You know, all this talk, we're talking about how we need to drill for more oil, for oil independence. Well, guess what? Some of that's a crock of shit for other reasons than we've actually realized to begin with. Get this from SolveClimate.com. Thank you, Gene. U.S. oil exports hit record pace. That's right, exports. Who knew that the U.S. is currently exporting 1.8 million barrels of oil a day? To make sure everybody does, Representative Edward J. Markey, Massachusetts, chairman of the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, sent a public letter to President Bush asking him to keep our oil at home. The letter didn't specify how, but it didn't miss the opportunity to take a shot at the GOP plan to open up protected offshore waters for oil drilling. At the current export rate, by the time the first barrel of oil could be produced from increasing offshore drilling, America would have already exported the equivalent of nearly 40% of the oil that is projected to lie beneath the protected areas offshore. Did you get that? Did you get that? We're exporting it faster than we could drill it. We're exporting more than we'd get. This is just profiteering. So all this, we gotta drill, drill, drill for the American people. No, bullshit, we gotta drill, drill, drill so that Chevron can export more of it to other people. The oiligarchy has gone completely batshit. It was no coincidence that Markey's letter was released just as John McCain paid a visit to an offshore rig off the coast of Louisiana. Exxon John hits again, in order to highlight his support for an increased domestic offshore drilling. As the public battle over access to oil in protected U.S. waters continues, Jad Muad in the New York Times explains why the stakes have gotten so high. It turns out the major oil companies, desperate for new sources of supply, have almost nowhere else to turn. And after reading this story on Think Progress, it will also become clear why a McCain election victory would deliver what the oil companies want more than anything else, a clear path to an endless fossil future. Muad reports that as late as the 1970s, the major oil companies were responsible for 50% of global oil production. Today, their production accounts for a mere 13%. That's because the 10 largest holders of petroleum reserves are state-owned companies. Again from the letter, oil company executives see a straightforward explanation, a trend known as resource nationalism. They contend that they have been shut out of promising regions by a rising assertiveness in the Middle East, in Russia, in South America, and elsewhere by governments determined to keep full control of their oil. This sense of being hemmed in helps explain why the Western oil companies want more offshore oil drilling in the United States. They see it as one of their few options. And it's a lot easier for these oil companies to influence U.S. government policy than the decisions of Russia's Gazprom or Iran's National Oil Company or Venezuela. And it looks like they've got the McCain campaign in a bear hug. Think Progress reports that Wayne Berman, McCain's National Finance co-chairman, who had bundled over $500,000 for his campaign, has lobbied for Chevron since 2004. McCain's chief congressional liaison, John Green, has lobbied for Chevron since 2005, and Richard Holt, an American McCain fundraiser and D.C. insider, has also lobbied for Chevron since 2005. Chevron. You know, that name seems to pop up in a lot of places now, doesn't it? Let's see. It was Chevron that named a tanker after Condoleezza Rice. That guy we installed over in Afghanistan used to work for Chevron, right? And was it not, correct me if I'm wrong, was it not a Chevron pipeline that is being built through Iraq? Interesting, isn't it? And if people say that the oil lobby doesn't partially run our government, you have your head so far up your ass, you're tasting your own shit. Jeez, Bob, it's a good thing we're not on broadcast radio. I'd be racking up, what, good $300,000-$500,000 worth of fines? Oh, the freedom of the internet, you gotta love it. You gotta love it. Bob says $275,000 per shit. Oh, man. It's all just words, people. It's all just words. Oh, it really can just get you a bit goofy, to say the least. Let's see. What else do they say here? It should come to no surprise that the McCain campaign chose to visit a Chevron-owned drilling platform. Kind of continues to go on with the VOD that I was just on. All this also explains why the battle over offshore drilling is just the leading wedge of an effort to remove government restrictions on the exploitation of unconventional fossil fuels, tar sands, oil shale, and the absolutely insane coal to liquids fuels. With access to global oil fields more restricted than ever, the oil companies are not going to be satisfied with the meager pickings from offshore wells. They're after the mother lode, which both McCain and President Bush identified in their calls for increased domestic oil production. Tap into the extraordinary potential of oil shale. So back to the letter. Oil shale is a type of rock that can produce oil when exposed to heat and other processes. In one major deposit, the Green River Basin of Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming, there lies the equivalent of about 800 billion barrels of recoverable oil if it can be fully recovered. It would equal more than a century's worth of current projected oil imports. And the writer says, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the endless fossil future. And never mind about all those U.S. oil experts or the horrors of oil shale production, the dirtiest fuel on the planet. This is what we're up against. And again, it falls to this anti-intellectualism. We have so much information at our fingertips that the way we run our society is absolutely killing us. That some cannot possibly see that there is the possibility of another way. That's why the Coal River Wind Project just excites me so. And I know Bob and the Net, Nick, all the people who have been on top of this battle for years are feeling their first glimmers of maybe not hope yet, but possibility. You know, to see that it's only been 2 days since the ad campaign kicked in on radio. And I was completely honored to be part of putting that together. They went from less than 1,000 signatures to last time I checked it was just under 4,000. And that's like in 48 hours. If we can do that in 48 hours, what's going to happen in a couple of months? Because they have done the right thing. They have gone and backed themselves up with all of the data. They have done all the math so that people can't weasel themselves out with bullshit arguments. They've shown that it can work. They've shown that it will actually create more jobs than the mountaintop removal mining is right now. So they're destroying the arguments of those who continue to deny the truth because their profits are more important than the reality. I'm so stoked with what they're doing, and I hope that it's just the first step in allowing people in West Virginia to reclaim their state, reclaim their mountains. You know, you look at this oil shale thing, you know, that'd be the same idea. Oh, we'll just fucking tear up the planet to power ourselves because we don't give a crap. As long as my house gets bigger, my gut gets fatter, I need more Viagra because my diet is shit. There we go, another 275 grand, Bob. But, I mean, it's just madness. But, you know, I mean, there are cracks beginning to form, and it just means that we have to keep hammering at them. Can't let down. Cannot let down for a second. Bob says, hell, write a check. Oh, yeah, rubber check. Anyway, and I failed to mention this the last couple of days before we run out of time. Very, very good friend of mine who I've mentioned before on the program, Miss Amanda Davis, who is one of the most talented singers I've ever known, actually has just been cast as one of the leads in the stage version of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, when it returns to Sydney here. I am very happy for her. I am very proud of her. She is one of the most talented women I've ever known. And this, I have a feeling, will just raise her up another notch, and she's just going to kick ass. So kudos, men. You kick ass. And I have no idea when that starts, but I reckon when it does, I'll end up in a musical theater for the first time in a long time. I probably wouldn't have gone to see the show unless she was in it. Great movie. And so, yeah, kick ass for her, and I bet it'll run for months. I think it did 9 months straight when it was here the last time. So it should be really, really good. The production company is good. It should all be awesome. Anyway, folks, I think we're kind of getting up, and we'll come back tomorrow. We've got plenty to do tomorrow to wrap up the week. So first, thanks to Bob Kincaid for producing today. Thanks to Ben Birch of the White Rose Society for the streaming and the archives and everything that he does for us. Thanks to Scott Berry at B1 Louder Productions for the music. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. You too can become part of the fight against mountaintop removal mining. And also go to coalriverwind.org and sign the petition if you haven't already. And as we say here on Fox Talk, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
Everybody knows.